Thank you for downloading this podcast of Robin Peake talking about footballer and coach Patrick O'Connell at MMU's Institute for Performance Research Symposium on Sporting Lives held on December the 4th, 2010.
Do through this paper is present his life within context and really look as well within what a lot of Edwardian players did after they finished their playing career and coaches who went abroad, as O'Connell did. Patrick O'Connell was an early 20th century Irish professional footballer and later manager. He played as a halfback in the English and Scottish First Divisions in the years enveloping the First World War and later coached in Spain's Premier League competition. He captained Manchester United and was given the same honour to lead his country in their historic victory over England in February 1914 as Ireland won their first ever home internationals championship. As a manager, he won trophies in Spain, including guiding Betis Balompié to their only ever league championship in 1935 and winning the regional Liga Mediterránea with Barcelona when football was disrupted by the Spanish Civil War. An Irish coach with a British pedigree, O'Connell's success in Spain was measured both by the 12 trophies that he won and also the extent to which he adapted and persisted with the country in comparison to both his peers and stay-at-home British coaches of today. Patrick Joseph O'Connell was born on the 8th of March 1887 to Patrick and Elizabeth, one of nine children and the eldest son. He grew up in North Dublin, living in the Drumcondra area of the city. Patrick O'Connell Sr. was a clerk at Boland's Cornmill, and Junior was said to have worked there as well, although the 1901 census lists him as a glass fitter at age 14. His social class was fairly typical for a would-be footballer. On Jones's Terrace, where he lived from 1899 to 1905, there was a family of bricklayers, a plumber, a few carpenters, and an unemployed sanitary officer. The street consisted mainly of the members of the skilled and semi-skilled classes 3 and 4. O'Connell's early years ran in tandem with the development of association football in Ireland. The Irish Football Association was formed at Belfast in 1880. And by the time O'Connell was born, football was being played in an organised setting in Dublin, and a priority of the IFA was to encourage the growth of the game outside of Ulster. In 1892, the Leinster FA was established in Dublin to promote the game in the province. Leinster FA grew from a membership of 11 clubs in 1899 to 65 just 2 years later. And this extraordinary growth can in part be attributed to the dissolution of the Army FA, but was also probably a response to the creation of a number of pitches for the association code across Dublin and the location of the Ireland v England match of 1900 at Lansdowne Road. And this decision was part of the IFA's missionary work, which aimed to encourage the growth of the sport in the south, despite international matches in Dublin taking a financial loss. And so, by the time O'Connell entered his teenage years, football was becoming an increasingly attractive leisure pursuit in Dublin. Furthermore, he lived just 15 minutes' walk from the pitches at Fairview Park, where he could play the sport. And although as a youngster he lived in three different houses, O'Connell and his family were never more than 100 metres from the Jones Road playing fields, where he could watch Dublin's best teams play. Bohemians had played matches there, as did Trentonville AFC in the early 1900s. By the time the Gaelic Athletic Association had purchased the playing fields in 1908 and renamed it Croke Park, 90 soccer clubs were registered with the Leinster FA. Patrick O'Connell played for two of them. His first known team was Frankfurt, a small club who played in the minor cup competitions and who were probably located in Phoenix Park. He then played for Stranville, a club who were formed around the turn of the century and who played just a 20-minute walk from his home. With them, O'Connell won the Leinster Junior Cup in May 1908, and there was double cause for celebration that same month when he married Ellen Treston, although it was probably forced upon him. She was 3 months pregnant with his child. By September, he had moved north to senior side Belfast Celtic, with Stranville acting as a sort of feeder club for them at that time. At Belfast Celtic, he was a regular starter as a centre-forward, but by the end of the 1908-09 season, he was spotted by the manager of Sheffield Wednesday and was signed and converted to a halfback. He made only a few appearances when others were injured, and after only 21 appearances in just over three seasons at Wednesday, he dropped down a league to 2nd Division Hull City in May 1912 for a transfer fee of £350. At Hull, he was a first-team regular, known as a sound and judicious player, who was as amusing on the field as he is off by the local press, who knew him as Patsy. When David Gordon was unable to lead the side, it was O'Connell who was appointed temporary captain. His consistent and capable play during the 1913-14 season attracted the attention of the Irish selectors as it had done 2 years previous. On Valentine's Day 1914, he captained Ireland to a memorable 3-0 triumph at Middlesbrough, and a month later he was part of the team which drew against Scotland, giving Ireland their first ever home international championships after 3 decades of trying. On form for both club and country, and with Hull struggling to remain solvent as a result of their high wage bill, O'Connell was bought by Manchester United in May 1914 for £1,000, and he was offered the maximum terms allowed, and he became United's second most expensive signing. It was at Old Trafford that he reached the pinnacle of his playing career, playing regularly for a leading club. The press recognised him as the club's best halfback, although accusations of poor ball distribution continued to be levelled against him, as had been noted during his days with Belfast Celtic. In early 1915, he was described by Athletic News as a much more finished and restrained player than he was years ago with Sheffield Wednesday. Then he was merely a wild Irishman, but experience has made him a calculating man. Yet the hot temperament alluded here must still have followed him, his anger being characterised by one cartoonist, and it was noted that during one match he caused a referee to limp when he accidentally kicked him on the ankle. O'Connell was the 6th Irishman to play for Manchester United, the first from outside of Ulster, and in January 1915 he became the first Irishman to captain the club. By this time, the war, which was supposed to be over by Christmas, was intensifying, and many of O'Connell's peers and teammates had signed up, although it was much more common to find footballers engaged in alternative wartime employment. O'Connell, along with some of his Manchester United teammates, found war supplies work at the Ford Motor Works in Trafford Park, and O'Connell became a foreman there. Clubs found the first wartime season a difficult period to operate in financially, with contractual obligations to fulfil despite a considerable fall in gate receipts. Manchester United had to delay the instalments of O'Connell's transfer fee for a full 12 months. At the end of March 1915, the expected announcement was made that owing to the ongoing war effort, there would be no summer wages for 3 months, and that upon the resumption of payments, the maximum wage would drop from £4 to £3 a week. Just days after this news, which limited their earnings, the footballers of Manchester United and Liverpool were brought into serious disrepute, as it was alleged and later proven that they had been involved in squaring a match between the two teams and placing money on the correct score. The match in question was at Old Trafford on Good Friday, the 2nd of April 1915, Manchester United winning by 2-0. It was a result that a few, if not many, punters had betted upon, and one which particularly helped United in their battle against relegation. Patrick O'Connell, captain of the home side, curiously missed a penalty in the second half when the score was 1-0. His shot was so extravagantly wide that, as reported, the referee consulted his linesman, convinced that something was amiss. The fix then, insufficiently subtle, sporting press and the authorities demanded to know who was involved. The commission, set up to investigate the match, issued their findings at Christmas, and it found 5 of those who played, including just one of the United team, Enoch West, guilty of prearranging the result for the purpose of betting and winning money thereby, and permanently suspended them from taking part in any football. As Athletic News commented, it is beyond the power of human credibility to assume that only one of the United players was in the know. O'Connell had been interviewed by the commission, but was not deemed guilty. However, as captain, he was probably never thought of as being entirely innocent either. Under relaxed registration rules, O'Connell spent the last wartime years playing as a guest for Rochdale Town and Clapton Orient when it became clear that he was surplus to requirements at Manchester United. In August 1919, Scottish side Dumbarton signed him for £200. O'Connell was by now growing estranged from his wife Ellen and their 4 children. It seems that they followed him up to Scotland for a while, only to return to Manchester. After a fairly uneventful year in Dumbarton, he returned to England. Responding to an advert offering good wages to experienced men, he signed for Ashington in May 1920 and moved to the North Eastern League side without his family. A year later, he was appointed as player-manager of the club, now elected to the newly formed 3rd Division North. He helped the club to 10th place in the league, but this was not deemed satisfactory by the directors, even though it was they who'd been picking the team. At the end of the 1921-22 season, he was offered for sale. However, with no bids forthcoming, he was released on a free transfer by the club in June. And whilst others like him shirked into obscurity in different fields of work, O'Connell embarked upon a coaching career in Spain, which would span 3 decades and 4 different systems of governance. Academics have drawn various conclusions as to the occupations that many early professional footballers took up upon retiring from playing. However, solid evidence relating to the spectrum of employment of former sportsmen is hard to locate. The consensus, drawn from a range of sources and much of it impressionistic, is that footballers at the lower end returned to their previous trades, while many of the footballers who made it to the top of their profession ventured into new trades as publicans or owners of small businesses, or advanced in their current trade, working with football clubs as managers, trainers and scouts. An attempt to offer something resembling quantitative data can be made by collecting some information from a popular source. From January to May 1930, Topical Times ran a series entitled Cup Heroes of Other Days and What Has Happened to Them. Presenting information on a player-by-player basis, it details the post-playing exploits of those footballers who appeared in FA Cup finals from 1898 to 1914, covering most of the winning sides and a few of the losing finalists. However, the series neither mentions every job that each player has or how long each player was engaged in these various jobs. It must also be remembered that, given the range of teams selected, FA Cup finalists, any chronicling of these details can only be said to be representative of the game's elite. Topical Times' Cup Heroes series provides information regarding the post-playing employment circumstances of 155 unique players. Around 5% of players took manual jobs in factories, the same number worked in the mines, and a considerable number were self-employed. 41% of our sample of players operated their own business, and of these, some ran shops as butchers, grocers, confectioners and tobacconists. 10 managed their own hotels, but the largest grouping of those who ran their own businesses were publicans, who made up 19% of the total sample. That almost 1 in 5 players was in the licensed trade adds substance to the stereotype of the ex-footballer as pub landlord. And yet again, we need to remember that this is only a sample of FA Cup finalists, players who were more likely than their less successful counterparts to have both the money to establish a business and the fame to attract the punters. And we would expect that a sample taken from less successful teams would produce more manual workers and less publicans. Nevertheless, it's clear that a large number of Edwardian footballers at the top of the ladder ran their own business after hanging up their boots, and that many of these were pub landlords. A sizeable number two of our sample remained in football, and the series mentions turnstile operators, groundsmen, directors and scouts. Many more were employed in a more hands-on role as managers, trainers and coaches, the latter term likely to denote the role now commonly referred to as manager. Topical Times lists 15 men as trainers and 35 as football managers or coaches, a combined unique sample of 46, just one less than the total number of all the publicans, hoteliers and colliers combined. Although it's recognised that even amongst the elite only a small number of footballers remained in the game in a variation of the coaching role, that 30% do is a significant number, and whilst our data is far from infallible, it's clear that Patrick O'Connell's post-playing career as a manager was not a surprising choice of career. It's even less surprising when we consider that O'Connell, as well as being player-manager at Ashington, was also the on-field captain there, as he had been at Manchester United and intermittently at Hull. Nicholas Fishwick has commented that a player with a reputation for maturity, reliability, good judgment and leadership might attract directors as potential management material. Selectors evidently thought that O'Connell fitted these criteria when they chose him as captain for club and country, as did the press, who variously called him a commanding figure and something of a leader. Furthermore, his industrial management experience would also have made him a choice candidate, and Neil Carter has argued that the development of the football manager was in line with similar developments throughout industry. He contends that the earliest football managers held duties not too dissimilar to those who managed in factories and industrial sites. O'Connell's experience as a foreman at the Ford Motor Works in Trafford Park further strengthened his candidacy. Of the 46 men from our sample who went into coaching or management, 12 of these took their trade abroad. Many were hired because of their background in British football, which had a reputation par excellence on the continent. Some were employed because of who they knew. Others got jobs through more official networks like the FA or the Employment Bureau of the Players' Union. And still others replied to adverts posted in the British sporting press. In May 1920, an advert appeared in Athletic News offering the position of coach for a club in Holland. And 2 years later, O'Connell replied to an advert posted in the same paper on behalf of a Spanish club who were seeking a first-class trainer coach. The Spanish club turned out to be Real Racing Club de Santander, and in June 1922, Patrick O'Connell replaced Englishman Fred Pentland at the club, which, like numerous other clubs in Spain, received royal patronage. Though O'Connell was Irish, his football pedigree was British, and it was sought after in Spain, where football's popularity really took off in the 1920s. Barcelona, Madrid, Athletic Bilbao all had British managers since before the Great War, and five different Englishmen won the Spanish Cup during the 1920s. O'Connell's reign at Santander lasted until 1929, during which time he met and bigamously married Ellen O'Callaghan, a red-headed Irish girl. Good Catholics don't divorce. At Santander, O'Connell was relatively successful. He led the Cup to seven successive wins in the local Federación Cantabria, although he never achieved much success in the Cup. By 1932, O'Connell moved to the city of Seville via stint at Oviedo to take over as coach of Betis Balompié, the royal prefix removed under the rule of the Second Republic. It's at Betis where he is most fondly remembered. In 1935, he guided the club to their sole La Liga championship. Only promoted to Spain's Premier Division 4 years previously, it was a fantastic footballing achievement, one recognised by the city authorities who gifted the club a new stadium. At Betis, O'Connell had twice guided his side to victories over FC Barcelona in the Cup. And this, coupled with his recent success at Betis, made him an ideal candidate to replace Franz Platko at Barcelona. In the summer of 1935, Patrick O'Connell became the coach of arguably Spain's biggest club at a time when the country was on the cusp of civil war. At Barcelona, Patrick O'Connell won the Campeonato de Catalunya in his first season, securing a bonus of 1,000 pesetas to add to his 1,500 pesetas monthly wage. That same season, he guided the club to the final of the Spanish Cup in June 1936. And there, his team met Real Madrid, the first time these two great rivals had met on Spain's greatest stage. The game finished 2-1 to Madrid, an ominous victory for the club who would become known as Franco's team against the Catalan side who would consistently oppose the regime. A month later, with the team on holiday and O'Connell back in Ireland, General Franco and his men take control of the Canary Islands and Spain lurches into civil war. As a club, Barcelona suffered heavily during the conflict. Its stadium was bombed and its president was shot dead by Falangist troops loyal to Franco. They managed to win a few trophies, organised regionally under extenuating circumstances, and then under threat financially and politically repressed, they were presented with the lifeline in April 1937. Mexican businessman and former Barcelona baseball player Manuel Masoriano got in contact with the club and offered them $15,000 plus expenses to embark upon a footballing tour of Mexico. The club readily agreed and a six-match tour over 2 months was arranged, commencing in June 37. O'Connell oversaw a two-month-long tour extending to four, and 12 of the 16 players enter exile in Mexico and France. O'Connell returned with a reduced party of players and staff, but by the closing stages of the conflict, he had left the country, along with the rest of the coaches from the British Isles, and stayed with his brother Larry in London. Following Franco's victory, he was corresponding with Barcelona, who were evidently expecting him to return. However, he declined to return to the club, and instead went back to coach Betis once more. In doing so, he became the only coach from the British Isles to return to Spain after the conflict, and although over 20 British coaches found employment in Spain during the 1920s, after the Civil War there was a dramatic drop in their number, steadily replaced by Hungarians, South Americans, as well as native Spaniards. In 1942, O'Connell made the short journey to CF Sevilla, where he led the club to the runners-up spot in La Liga, and at that time, their joint ever highest position. Eventually, his coaching career petered out, coaching Betis and Santander once more, before carrying out some scouting work for teams in the south of Spain. That even during these years, he didn't take a second Irish wife back to their homeland or to England shows just how settled he was in his adopted country. That he continued to find work defied the decline of the British-educated coach abroad. In the 1950s, he was tracked down by Daniel Treston, his son from his first marriage, who had abandoned his O'Connell name in favour of his mother's maiden name. O'Connell had adopted a ne'er the twain shall meet mentality, and neither of the two families knew the other existed. He cannily introduces Daniel as his nephew, further embittering his son, who was open about his hostility towards his father. This charade over, he remained in Seville, except for when he went to London to be with his brother in his final days. Patrick O'Connell died on the 27th of February 1959 in St Pancras, aged 71. The direction of Patrick O'Connell's career upon ending his playing days was not altogether unusual. His experience in leading men, both on the field and in the factory, combined with his pedigree in British football, eased his path into coaching. That he coached abroad was certainly uncommon but not altogether rare, and his initial move to the north of Spain was in keeping with British coaches who took up positions there. However, aside from his unique experience at Barcelona, O'Connell does stand out from the other coaches in Spain due to his staying power. No other British coach had a career in Spain which straddled both sides of the Civil War. That Patrick O'Connell achieved not just success, but longevity in his coaching career in Spain marks him out both among his peers and the modern British manager.
Thank you, Robbie.